Well, every Christmas I make one homemade Christmas present. Every Christmas I go to Costco and I make a photo calendar for the grandparents of all the year's photos of our family. And since there are now five of us with digital devices, it's become a daunting task because there's literally 1,000 photos to go through. But the positive thing about that is that I can usually find that one that shows my good side, right? Or I can usually find a photo where I'm having a good hair day, or when I only have one chin that day instead of two. So it's quite the advantage, but it does have its disadvantages. For instance, when you have a photo, because it's an accurate representation of a moment in time, sometimes it reveals things you didn't want it to. Like when it's in that unflattering category of photo. You know, when it's in its unphotoshopped state, it might show things you don't want. For instance, that blouse that you thought looked so good on you in the dressing room, you know, it just fit you just right, and you look at it and you think, what was I thinking? Or you start to break out and you think, what am I, a teenager? What's with this, right? Or those moments when your children are rebelling during the Christmas family photo shoot, and there they are, snapped for all time for you to remember what was happening. Well, that happens sometimes, and there's unflattering photos, but when you do a calendar project like I did, inevitably you come to a spot in the year where there is not a single good photo of that particular event that you wanted to document. And you're like, oh, how could that be with 1,000 photos that I can't find one single good one? And so there's always one unflattering photo that makes its way into the calendar. Well, this year's unflattering photo was one that my son John took when the kids were parasailing. And they're 1,200 feet up, and he's got a GoPro out, and he's taking a shot of them. He's holding onto a pole with a GoPro, and he's taking a shot of them parasailing. Okay, now, all three kids are in the shot, so I had to keep it. And you could actually see the water down below, 1,200 feet, and the boat, okay? And their little feet, well, okay, big and little feet, are dangling in the air. I just had to use that photo, but it wasn't very flattering because they didn't have good expressions on their face. And they were kind of cut off, but it was like, I had to use it because it was so cool and it really documented that moment the best. As Mike and I were safely, securely seated down in the boat below, I wanted to see what it was like up there. So that was the unflattering, and my kids even balked at, now why would you use that photo? But I said, I had to. It's the only one that showed what I wanted it to, that accurate picture. Well, another thing that happens with my photo project and my calendar is that undoubtedly some of the photos need explanation. So when we hand it to the grandparents, inevitably one of us has to sit down with them and talk to them about, what's that? Where was that? And why did you include that? Because some photos need context to them. Well, today we're going to see a unique set of snapshots from the life of Gideon. And unfortunately, many of them are going to be the unflattering variety. And unfortunately, they're not of nothing kinds of things like bad hair days and blemishes, nor are they great spiritual victories and wonderful godly moments like we saw last week. This is not going to be the week that you walk out feeling like you just got a big hug, like you got from Stephanie Schwartz last week. Because these photos are going to show things that run the gamut from unwise to compromise to full-blown apostasy. Because God in his sovereignty kept the camera rolling through Gideon's good, bad, and even sinful moments of his life. And I have to say something for Gideon, though. I'm not making excuses for him, but I want to remind you that he did not have a Bible in his lap. He also didn't have a Compass Bible Church down the street from him. And he was not surrounded by a bunch of godly friends and mentors that could help him make good and godly choices. He quite literally lived in a time when everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So some of those snapshots are not going to be very flattering, They're, in fact, they're going to be tragic and confusing. And just like with the grandparents, some of them are going to need a little explanation. So I pray that with God's wisdom and study, that I might be able to give you some explanation for some of these bizarre things that we see here. But as we flip through them, I want you to remember that God is the one who chose what pictures went in the calendar of your Bible. And he chose these for a very important reason. Romans 15:4, you don't need to turn there. I'm going to keep you in Judges all day. But in Romans 15:4, it says that these things happened to them in the Old Testament as examples, and they were written down for our instruction. So even though they seem bizarre, God shows them to teach us something. We're just going to figure it out today. So I'm going to ask you to turn in your Bibles to God's calendar in Judges 8. And as I said, we'll spend the whole time there. This week, we're going to be looking at the third act of Gideon's life. In the first act of his life, we looked at it right before Christmas. It's when Gideon was called. And he was called specifically to defeat the Midianites. Right? That's what he was told to do. And the Midianites were terrorists, by the way, who swarmed the country and took everyone's food and even killed a whole bunch of people. Second act was last week. And this is the one where Gideon has his big moment. His big moment in the sun where they take the jars and the torches and smash them and everything. And at that point, God has the Midianites turn on one another and attack one another. And lots of them are killed by one another in the confusion. At the end of that chapter, though, we studied, but didn't discuss it from up here, we studied that, at the end of chapter 7, Gideon then calls all the people, the soldiers that he has dismissed. And they all get called back because the Midianites start running away. Okay. But they get to the Jordan River. And at that point, it looks like maybe the Midianites could escape. They could cross the river and safely get back to their own territory and their own land. So Gideon calls out at the end of chapter 7 the big, strong Ephraimites. They're not his tribe, it's another tribe, the Ephraimites. And they are the biggest and strongest tribe in Israel, except for Judah. And they're big, burly soldiers, and God calls them out through Gideon, and they are quick. They join in the fight. They help track down these two leaders that we're going to read about, and they kill them, the two commanders of Midian's army. And that brings us right to chapter 8, the third act of Gideon's life. And I have to tell you, the battle that started at midnight with the jars and the torches and stuff, okay, that was only a couple hours ago, okay? This is the same time period. This isn't weeks later. They had the battle. They went chasing after them. Now they're at the Jordan River. It's probably morning, okay? Just to give you some context of what's happening. Gideon and his 300 men are pursuing the Midianites. And in this point, in verse number 1, Ephraim is confronting Gideon. Okay? Verse 1, they say, "What is this that you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they accused him fiercely. And he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you?" And then he tells them this story of the vineyard. You know, and he's basically talking about why their military victory was more important than his. And the reason that he gives is because, it says in the verse here, because God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. You see, Gideon is telling the Ephraimites that the job that they did in mopping up or gleaning, he used that word, mopping up the battle and killing these two commanders was super important. And God allowed them to do that amazing, wonderful thing. Because, see, Ephraim is upset. They're upset because why? Because Gideon didn't call them out earlier. They weren't part of the initial band of soldiers, and they didn't like that very much, and they're coming to complain to Gideon about him. But Gideon, in great wisdom, uses gentleness and respect, and he diffuses the situation with the Ephraimites by telling them, "No, you did a great job. You did even something better than me." One of the lessons to learn from Gideon is about his gentleness and his tact and his soothing here. Well, in God's sovereignty, God did not prompt Gideon to call them out earlier. God did not prompt him to call out the big, burly soldiers to come out and fight in the initial conflict. Probably because God knew that these guys would not take too kindly to being turned away. When he thinned down the ranks to 300 and said, oh, you can leave. You know, when it's the Navy SEALs and you're saying, get out of here, we don't need you, it might not have gone so well. Or whatever, the Rangers, or whatever the top guys are. They don't take too kindly to that. So God, in his sovereignty, did not have them called out. And yet, at just the right time, God called out the Ephraimites, and to their credit, they jumped at the chance to serve. They rallied with the troops. They ran out, and they did what had to be done to fight. They had a reputation for being people that would support the God's leaders and God's battles, because they had already, in the book of Judges, they'd already helped Ehud, and they'd already helped Barak. Both times, Ephraim had come out faithfully, and here they did it again, and God gave them a big win. They got to take down the commanders. Well, this, because of them and their example, that's where we're going to get our very first point of tonight, from the Ephraimites. And point number one is, be adipat for Christ's cause. Be adipat for Christ's cause. Now, we need to learn from the Ephraimites, and we need to follow their example. We need to be ready to act just like they were whenever God asks us to. And I love the fact that these guys did not have to be convinced. They did not have to be coaxed. They did not have to be reassured. They did not have to have all the answers. God called, they came. God's men said, I have a job for you to do. They did it. They were there just like that. They didn't need any extra time to convince them to do it. And they're commended in our Bibles here because they were adipat, because they were ready to do anything, any place, any time. And they're a good example for us, of course. And they are refreshing for us because not everyone has this kind of response when God asks them to do something for him. Well, we need to be like them and eager. Moving on to verse 4, it says, and Gideon came to the Jordan, and he crossed over, and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted yet pursuing. So he said to the men to Sukkoth, the men of Sukkoth, please give loaves of bread to the people that follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. And the officials of Sukkoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your army? So Gideon said, well then, when Yahweh has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of wilderness and with briars. And then he travels a few miles farther to a town called Peniel. And in God's sovereignty, I was so excited to open the DBR this morning, because what town is in our DBR? Peniel, this very town, when Jacob is going and he's heading back to Canaan, and he's going to meet Esau, and he's so afraid, and he prays through the night, and then he wrestles with God. That's in this town, Peniel. So he's in this town, Peniel, which is a little bit farther than Succoth, and Gideon asks the same thing. He asks for some food, and he gets the same answer that he got with Succoth, and he ends up threatening them just like he did Succoth. Yikes, this is kind of harsh, right? It's kind of harsh, but let's see if we can figure out why. First of all, as I told you, it's the same day, right? The battle started at midnight, except now they've traveled 50 miles on foot pursuing terrorists. It's now afternoon. So they've pulled an all-nighter, traveled 50 miles, and they're still in pursuit. So they're kind of wiped out, okay? Secondly, as the commander of the army, Gideon could have told Succoth and Peniel, you have to give me the supplies, and they could have taken him by force. It was a time of war. The commander of the army could have come in and just taken everything out of their cupboards. But he doesn't. Okay? Then, Succoth and Peniel, they're not just withholding food from the troops. They're also rude about it. I mean, can't you tell that from the way they say it? They're just rude. And they start saying something about, you don't have the hands yet. Remember? Well, the custom of the day was that when a battle was won, the winning army would go throughout the battlefield and they would cut off a hand of each one of the dead enemy soldiers and bring them back to their king or commander, and it would be a kind of body count. This is how many we've killed. So he says, because you don't have the hands, I know you haven't defeated them, so I'm not giving you anything. That's what they said. They were super disrespectful to God's leader here. Well, Succoth and Peniel, you also need to know that they're from Gad. Now, Gad was a place, when I taught on Deborah, I told you that Gad is a place that did not come when Deborah and Barak were fighting either. They were called out and they refused, okay? Now, back then, they could have had the excuse that maybe the battle's just too far away, right? But now we've crossed the Jordan River and we're over in Gad territory, and Succoth and Peniel, they're Gadite towns, which means the battle is now at their back door. There's no excuse that it's too far away anymore. They're right there. And you know, people were risking their lives to protect the Israelites from Midian at this point. All the soldiers, including Ephraim and all the other tribes that helped out. And Succoth and Peniel weren't even willing to give them food. Now, hospitality in this day when there was no hotels, no restaurants, and no grocery stores was not just a nice thing to do. It was actually commanded. Israel was commanded to take care of travelers, especially Israelite travelers. And here's God's army, God's people, God's commander coming through, and they refused to give them anything. Even in the New Testament, hospitality was super important. And if you remember in the story of the sheep and the goats, Jesus praises and rewards those who feed the hungry. And he chides and he condemns those who don't. This was a big deal. This wasn't like a nothing thing. This was a big deal. Now, some people say, yes, but Succoth and Peniel, they must have been afraid. I mean, what if Gideon didn't win and the Midianites came back and took their revenge? Yeah, that's probably what would have happened. But when God asks you to do something, or when God's leader says you need to do something, even if there's risks involved, you do it. You know, Jesus was very clear in Mark 8:35. He said, whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel will find it. You see, that's the reason why Adipat is challenging. It's because it's a risk and it's going to probably cost you something. I mean, how could it not? Anything, any place, any time. Of course it's going to be risky. When God asks us to do something, we should never shirk from our responsibility like Succoth and Peniel did. Well, if Succoth and Peniel were Israelites, then how can we possibly explain their disobedience and their apathy here? All I have to do is tell you to look in the mirror. Just because you're one of God's people doesn't mean you always do what's right, right? It doesn't mean that you always do what God says every single moment of every single day. Ever done anything you shouldn't do? Of course. Ever not done something that God asked you to do? Of course, right? Just because we're God's people doesn't mean we don't mess up, which is why God gave us great passages like 1 John 1:8 and 9. In 1 John 1:8 and 9, you don't have to turn there, but it's the one that talks about how Christians should never say they don't sin. It says, and when we do sin, we need to quickly go and confess it, get clean, get right, and make a change. So even if tonight you start to think, maybe I'm not quite as adipat as Ephraim was. Maybe I wouldn't jump up from my comfortable life, from my sofa, from my job, from whatever it is I'm doing that's got my time to do something God's people asked me to or God's leader asked me to. So if you're here tonight and you think, maybe I'm not quite as adipat as I should be, maybe I'm more like Succoth and Peniel than Ephraim, confess it, make a change, do it now. That's all it takes. Well, then in verses 10 to 12, we find out that Zebah and Zalmunna and a fraction of the original army, which was 135,000 soldiers, remember they said it was like they were like locusts? They killed 120,000 of them, but there's still 15,000 left. So this small fraction are out there with Zebah and Zalmunna, and they get really far away. So far away that they start to feel secure, like, there's no way Gideon's ever going to catch up to them. They get almost home, basically. But Gideon takes a back road, and God gives him the element of surprise, and he ends up capturing the kings and the rest of the army. And because of that, he captures them and then starts trudging back home. So he's crossed the Jordan River, and he's going to go back across, cross the Jordan River, go back all the way to his town, back all those miles. Now, from this point on, even in your study, you probably realize this, Gideon seems a little over the top, shall we say. That's how we'll put it. Now, I don't know for sure that he's over the top, because God doesn't tell us he is. I don't know. We'll have to find out. We'll have to find out what God thought in the end. But he seems a little over the top to us. And there's going to be some not so flattering photos coming up at this point from now on out. Right? They're going to need some explanation. So let's see what we can do. Verse 13 tells us that they come across this man, and now, they, like I said, they have the kings and they're trudging back home. Okay? They come across a man of Succoth who happens to know how to write, number one, God's sovereignty, and happens to know all the elders or leaders of Succoth, 77 of them, and he gives them all the names, okay? Which, by the way, is actually gracious because the 77 men who are responsible are the ones whose names he gave him. That's very important. Verse 15 says, and he came, that's Gideon, came to the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zebah and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted? And he took the elders of the city, and he took thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth and Peniel a lesson. And he tore down the tower of Peniel, and he killed the men of the city. Yikes! This seems super harsh to us. I mean, these guys are Israelites. Yikes, that's terrible. That's really harsh. This photograph helps us to remember that God will lovingly discipline his people who are not willing to do anything, any place, any time. He loves his people. He knows what he's asked them to do. He knows what he's asked us to do. He knows when we are not doing it. And he will bring painful things into our lives to bring us back on the path of obedience and being anything, any place, any time kinds of people. He knows when we're preserving our schedule or our sleep or our comfort or our routine or our money or our time. And one of those things is coming before us being as out of pat as we possibly could be for him. He knows. And when he sees that in his people, he tries to get them to change. He tries to get them to see what he wants them to do and get them back on the right path. And someday the Bible says that we will all stand at the Bema Seat of Christ if you're a real follower of Christ, and you will not be condemned because Jesus paid for our sin. But at the Bema Seat, you will be evaluated. And what you did for Christ, what you did that was out of pat, will be rewarded. And what you chose not to do will make you suffer loss, 1 Corinthians 3:15 tells us. Now, if you're really saved and you aren't living an out of pat life, you're going to have a price to pay that day. But sometimes God makes us pay a price somewhere along the way as well, as he lovingly disciplines us and uses pain in our lives to get us back in line. That's what Hebrews 12:7-11 is all about. It describes how when we are God's kids, he loves us enough to get us back on the path, and he uses pain to do it. Jesus clearly told us, if you want to be a disciple, you have to, you must, it's a requirement that you deny yourself and you take up your cross and you follow him. But, of course, in the midst of the godly moments and good choices in your life, as we said earlier, there will be times when you don't live that way, and neither do I. And those are going to be times when God comes in and uses pain to redirect us. But I want you to realize that these people, remember I told you they're from Gad? He told you that on purpose. Because they're one of the people that didn't help Deborah. And you know what God did then? All he did was reprimand them. They got written up in that song in Deborah. Deborah's song, it said that the Gadites didn't come and help. The first time, that's what he did. All he did was chide them. This is another day. This is another time. And the same people, the Gadites, now have a different situation. And God is redirecting them in a new way. But the first time, he was very gracious and tried to get them back on the path. God loves us so much that he will not let us rebel for very long. Remember the church in Corinth? The Bible's really clear. It tells us that because they took the Lord's Supper wrong, some of them were sick, and some of them even died. God loves us and wants to get us back on the right path. Just like you love your children, and when you see them running in the street, you're going to use pain to help them get back where they're supposed to be, a safe place. Now, before we leave this point, I have to make sure we look at one last group. We saw the Ephraimites, right? They were Attapat. We saw Succoth and Penuel, who were God's people, not so Attapat, okay? But there's a third group of people in this first big chunk of Gideon's story. And these people are the people who could care less about Attapat. That's because they're the people who completely oppose and reject God in every way, shape, or form. Three different kinds of people, okay? Verse 18, we're going to talk about those people. Then Gideon said to Zebah and Zalmunna, "Where are the men whom you killed at Tabor?" And we go on to find out that Zebah and Zalmunna have killed Gideon's brothers at an earlier time. We didn't know that before this. And he tells his son, Jether, his firstborn son, "Kill them." Jether won't do it. And so Zebah and Zalmunna say to Gideon, "Rise yourself and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength." And Gideon steps up and he does it. And here again, we have another really tough photo to explain. He's just killing people. Well, okay. Let's have a little bit of context, a little bit of explanation here, right? This picture, this whole set of verses right here shows us probably one of the reasons why God chose Gideon for this task in the first place. Because the Midianites have killed his brothers. And in the law, if someone in your family was murdered, the closest living relative was the one who was supposed to execute justice on that person. And just like you would turn in the murderer of your brother or sister, your husband or your child, to our governing authorities, so too, Gideon did what the law of his day told him to do, and he got justice for the victims in this situation. And it seems really crazy to us that Zebah and Zalmunna would kind of goad, did you notice that? They were kind of goading Gideon into killing them, and we're like, what's with that? Okay, well, Jether, they didn't want to be killed by Jether. And here's a couple reasons why. One is, it was a disgrace to be killed by someone who was young and untried. It was much better to be in status to be killed by a great warrior, okay? But secondly, it's also a lot more painful to be killed by someone who doesn't know what they're doing, okay? Which is why Zebah and Zalmunna goaded Gideon, the great warrior now, into doing the job that needed to be done. They knew it was coming. And please don't feel sorry for these people. You do realize that these two guys were the ones who planned and led and executed the terrorist attacks that have been going on for years in Israel. These are the men responsible. And this picture, as horrible as it is for us, reminds us that God will hold those accountable who oppose him, who reject him. This third group of people will be one day judged by God and held accountable. Well, before we move on to the next point, I want to make sure that I appeal to you Christians out there one last time to be Attapat. But instead of using the paddle like Gideon's been using, I want to use a carrot, okay? I want to make sure that you know it is important and it is beneficial to be Attapat. Remember, Ephraim is commended for it. But God promises that we too will be compensated when we are eager and faithful to do what he wants. And again, I was so excited in the DBR this morning because in God's sovereignty, the verse I'm going to quote to you was right there. Matthew 10:42 tells us that when we serve, no matter how big the size of our service, that God sees it and God will repay. Matthew 10:42 says, whoever gives one of these little ones, that's a Christian, not a child. Whoever gives one of these little ones even a cup of cold water because he's my disciple, truly I say to you, he will by no means lose his reward. Yes, God will discipline those who are unfaithful, but he will also richly reward those of us who are eager to do anything, any place, anytime. Well, to get our next point, we have to move to verse 22. And verse 22 says, then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us and your son and your grandson also, for you've saved us from the hand of Midian. Yahweh will rule over, or he says, Gideon says, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. Yahweh will rule over you. And from a human perspective, this makes perfect sense, really. I mean, they saw Gideon out there leading the army that fought and defeated the Midianites. So it makes sense that they would ask him to be their king. But see, Gideon knew that God was the one that was really responsible. That's why he said, let God rule over you. And that was good. That was a good start that Gideon made. But he didn't quite go all the way. He knew the truth. Let's put it this way. He had good